Hi, my name is Elijah. I'm from the States, Nashville, Tennessee, the music city of the United States. And so I came here. Microsoft invited me to talk about some about the web, meaning JavaScript, HTML5, CSS3, and jQuery. I gave this talk at Mix last year, and it's targeted toward people who tend to really know C-sharp really well, or Java, or some type of language that feels like that. And that type of person comes to the web, because, you know, a lot of things are the web these days, and the syntax looks so similar that they're like, I don't really have to learn this from scratch. I could just use what I already know and kind of make it work. And the thing is, at the beginning, you make progress, and you're like, oh, well, it is the same. But then as your application gets larger and larger, you start losing hair, and it turns gray because you're pulling it out, and you're just very frustrated. You're like, this stupid toy language, JavaScript, I can't believe people like it. So anyway, this talk is to try to describe the differences between the two and how hopefully you'll have a little more sanity by the end of the talk. So I'm Elijah Manner. I am a Microsoft MVP in the ASP.NET world. I work for Appentoo, which is a small company. We do jQuery consulting, training, things like that. And if you want to contact me later, here's my email and Twitter. I'll have this at the end as well. So this talk really stemmed from one of my first projects at Appentoo. Something I also do is front-end architecture reviews. So companies will come to us and say, hey, can you come into our company and look at our front-end code and just give us recommendations? So the first client I had was a Microsoft client. And all the developers were C-sharp developers, just as I was. And they were learning to write a whole JavaScript library for the first time. And so I saw all the same mistakes that I've made over and over again. And I was like, hey, this might be interesting information for people. And so, and then I wrote a series of articles on a website called enterprisejQuery.com. So the first thing, it's not really something that people do wrong, is just a false understanding of falsy values. I know it's kind of a confusing statement, but in a lot of languages you're familiar with, Boolean is true or false. You know, cut and dry. Maybe if you did some C code a long time ago, you know, a zero is also considered false. Well, JavaScript goes a little bit further. There's actually six different values that could basically be false, like if it was an if statement or in a while statement. And these are false, which makes sense. That's a false value. Null, and you're like, okay, well, that kind of makes sense. If I test for something and it happens to be null, that would kind of be false. Undefined, in JavaScript, you don't have to declare your variables. It's a good thing if you do, and we'll talk about that later. But that would also be considered false. An empty string is false, and that could confuse you and be one of those head-banging experiences. So you just need to learn that. So if you had an if statement and a variable that had the value empty string, that would evaluate to false. Zero is false, and you're like, okay, that's like a C. And not a number. So if you do some arithmetic and it comes out to something that's not a number, it would be NaN. So those are the six things that can be false. Anything else is true. If you had an object that had nothing in it, that's true. And really, anything else that you could think of, that's true. So we're going to use these concepts throughout the whole talk. And so just kind of remember these six. And you should begin. So based on those principles of falsy values and truthy values, I see a lot of the similar code in JavaScript as if it were C#. So, for example, one of the worst errors you could have in C#, at least in my opinion, is the big exception that object ref not, you know, null reference, you know, ah, you know. So in my code, I'm always testing for not null and that there's a length, and like I'll have all these checks everywhere in my code. And it seems to mess it up, look messy, but I'm like, I'm so determined not to have the error pop up. And it's such a common thing in C# that there are other methods like is null or empty. And I think recently there's is null or empty or white space. It's such a common thing that the framework's actually starting to pick that up. So I see that same type of syntax in JavaScript. Someone will write this in JavaScript, even though, if you know the falsy values that we just talked about, they could have just tested the variable itself, because that's testing six things. It's testing that it's not undefined, that it's not null, that it has a value, that it is not a number, and all those six. It's doing it in one concise thing because of falsy values. And so instead of doing something like this, this is a dead giveaway that you probably came to the language without learning like the basic concept of falsy values. So it's fine if you do that. Just know now this is the way, like if you looked in jQuery or other libraries, this is the paradigm that is used. In the same vein, setting default values, like it's common to, you test if it's null, and if it is null, you set a value. Like this is one way to do that. That's okay. Another way to do it is use the ternary, which some people like it, some people don't. So like you're testing using the falsy values that's not null, that's not undefined, that's not zero, etc. If it is, then just assign it back. But if it's faulty, give it some default value. So that's kind of. But then actually, C# has the double question mark, which does that for you. Unfortunately, JavaScript doesn't have a double question mark. But what it does have is the double pipe, which is the OR statement. And so since they are falsy values, it will first test the left side because it's a shortcut expression. So if any of these things is faulty, then it will try to evaluate this one, and it will return that value. So essentially what this is doing is it null or undefined or any of those six? And if it is, then go ahead and set the default value to this one. But if it is truthy, then it just redefines the same thing back to the variable. So it's a slight shortcut, and it's a very common thing you see in JavaScript development, especially like the hardcore libraries, like YUI, Prototype, Dojo, jQuery. So the main takeaway is just to memorize those six falsy values. And things will start to become more terse in your JavaScript. A lot less statements, lines of code. The next biggest thing is using the wrong comparison operators. Now, if you were to come to JavaScript without like taking a book and like learning from the beginning, or if you learned a long time ago when the resources weren't very good, I'm not going to name names, but there's some websites that are really outdated that you probably should not learn from. But you would look at these statements, okay, 0 equals empty string, 0 equals tab, character turn, line feed. These all evaluate to true. And you're like, what? Am I supposed to remember these things? Like, false is equal to a string with a 0 in it, and that's true? You're like, what kind of crazy language is this? And that's because there's actually a triple equals and a not double equals. But what this is trying to do is trying to be helpful, but really you never want to use it, like, ever. Maybe in one case. But what this is trying to do is trying to coerce each side of the expression into the same type. It's trying to be smart for you, but what it does is it makes it extremely confusing and hard to predict and more prone to errors. And so try not to use this at all, the double equals. There is a triple equals that does probably what you think. So if we were to compare all these again, obviously a number is not a string. That's false. Obviously a number is not the same number inside of a string. And again and again. So use the triple equals. It looks kind of funny at first, but you get used to it. In the same fashion, there's a not double equals, which is basically it doesn't coerce each side of the statement. It just keeps the same type and compares it that way. So that should save you some headache as well. So the takeaway of that is always use the triple or the double, not double equals. This is not necessarily wrong, declaring an object or an array using the new syntax, but it's not necessary. There's actually like one extra step behind the scenes when the code's actually ran that is not necessary, because there's actually literal notations for these. And it's just to create a new object, you use the curly braces. And do you make a new array, you just use the square brackets. The other one's not wrong, but you'll see this syntax more prevalent in people that write JavaScript all the time and those who write the libraries as well. The nice thing about using the syntax with objects is you could create, and this, some of this looks kind of familiar to some of the new features in C# from the last several years, but you can, you know, create full objects, you know, immediately instead of saying, have to say new object and then object dot first name, object dot last name. You could just kind of fill it out using this object literal notation, which is really nice. You could even assign functions in line, like right here. And then same with arrays, you can immediately give them values. It's just a lot nicer and nice and terse. So the main takeaway is to try to use the literal forms of creating a new object and a new array. And try to use the new keyword for really newing up custom constructors that you may have made. We'll kind of look at that later. You don't really want to use Boolean much. There's native types like Boolean and things like that. And then there's these wrappers that were made kind of as an afterthought in the language to make it feel more like Java at the time. But it turns out those are problematic. We're not really going to talk about it too much right now. But so really when you want to use the new keyword is like for date, obviously, and then for any new objects that you create, that you define. The next thing, what I see, there is a for n type of operator. And you might feel like that's like a for each or a way to iterate over a collection of things. And it's really not. It's not meant for that. But you'll see people use it, and you'll see confusing results. So let's look at this example real quick. We have an array. We're using the literal notation, which is nice. And then we're immediately accessing the fifth index. Even though we didn't create memory, we're just going to shove it in there because we didn't actually say it. So what that does is creates, it still has the indexes 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, but they have undefined in them just because we haven't put anything. And so now we have an array of length 6 because it just says, where's the last place that has real data? And you're like, okay, that sort of makes sense. And then you're like, oh, cool, there's this for n thing. I could like loop over the array. But unfortunately what happens is it's not really doing what I would have thought it would have done. I would expect, you know, 0 undefined, 1 undefined, 2 undefined, 3 undefined, 5 test, but it only prints out the thing that's the only thing that has a value. So if you were to loop over this, the output is only 5 and test. You're like, well, that's stupid. That's not very helpful. And it turns out there's a different use case for this, and we'll talk about when's a good time to use this. So what you'd probably want to do for an array, is just use the for with the iterator and just, you know, iterate it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And that gives you kind of what you expect because you have control of the index and you're just looping over it and printing out. So, you know, not crazy things, but just things that you usually have to run across one time and then learn from it. The other problem with the for n, I'm slightly jumping ahead of myself, but what for n is really good for is if you want to iterate over the keys of an object. Because an object in JavaScript is just like a key value pair. Like think of it like a hash map or a hash table. So that's all an object is. It has a key. The value might be a function. The value might be a primitive type. So the for n is really meant to iterate over the keys so that you could get the values. And so here again, we're creating an array. We put test in it. Its length is 6, but now we're doing something clever as we're mucking with the prototype of the array. Now, a prototype, if you don't know it, think of it as like inheritance in like C#. So you could have like a base class and that has stuff in it. So it's kind of like that. So imagine that we're modifying the base class of an array, and I'm adding something stupid, like some variable. And so now I'm going to iterate over the array, which looks like just before. It should only have one thing in it. But when I iterate over it, I do get 5 tests. But then the sum variable came up. Like, I didn't want that. I just wanted the things inside my array. So so anything that's on the prototype, it bleeds through the foreign as well. And that can be confusing. And you might, well, I don't want that. And you're like, and maybe you don't know how to get around that. And it can be very frustrating. So the main takeaway, and I'll show you how to alleviate that later. The main takeaway is to only use it on objects. And the intention is to iterate over the keys. The order of the keys is not set in stone. Typically, they happen to always be the same. But the spec, you know, says it doesn't have to be in the order. This is the next point. Sorry. Yeah, so the intent is to use it on objects, just like I said. But you still have the bleeding problem, which we mentioned before, where it goes over the things in the prototype, your base class. So there's a way to protect that. And unfortunately, it's another if statement. So it kind of clutters up the code. But so this is the key inside of your object. So it's looping over the keys. So now you have the key. Well, the object in question has a method name called hasOwnProperty. And so it's basically like, here's my array and here's my base class. And so I'm like, do I own this key? And it's like, no, you don't. It owns, the base class owns it. And so if that's the case, then, either run the code or don't run the code. And let's take an example. So here I'm creating a person constructor, which is kind of a way of creating a class, sort of, in C#. You kind of think about it that way. So now I have a constructor. So now I could extend that and add some extra properties on the person base class, we'll call it. So now we're going to new up a John Smith, and we're going to new up a Linda Davis using the new, which we talked about before. It's okay to use it if you're defining your own constructors. As a side note, if you declare your own constructors, it's best practice to capitalize it. There's nothing special or magical about that, but it helps other developers know, hey, this is something special that probably should be newed up. You don't see everyone do that, but you'll see a lot of people. And if you follow that paradigm, then even more people will be on the same page. So what we're doing now is, since we're inheriting these properties, is married and has kids, we'll say, hey, John is, he's married. And so we could manipulate things on the prototype just like normal. And so now we're going to show two ways of looping. One with the foreign without protection. Okay, maybe I shouldn't use that word. That without the if statement. And so it will actually print out first name, last name, which was on the constructor, and also the things that were on the base type. But if we put this extra check in, that Linda, do you own that property that we're iterating over? And if the answer is yes, then it only prints out the things that it owns. So for Linda, we would expect only to see first name and last name, because someone else might be manipulating the prototype and you don't know it. So you might just want the things that is on the object itself. So the best practice for this one is if you're using a foreign statement, try to use that if statement to make sure it owns it. Unless for some reason you really wanted everything, and it very well might be. Let me show you real quick. These are all JS Fiddles. I don't know if you noticed that, but it's a website that allows you to, like, anytime you have a bug or if you want me to help you with code, I would say, hey, can you recreate that in a JS Fiddle? So here's like an HTML window. You put all your HTML in here, all your JavaScript here, all your CSS here. It renders here. You could change your libraries, add new ones in, and it creates a small URL. You share it with people. You could comment it. You could fork it. You could do a lot of stuff with it. Anyway, embed it on your blogs. So But I just wanted to show you, if I add prototype in here, which is a different library, it's, you know, similar to jQuery in what it does, but it manipulates the base classes of native types like arrays and strings. And so if I actually include this and run this again, when I'm iterating over my array, you'll see down here that not only got 6 and 5 tests, but it got a bunch of methods that it augmented to the base class, like a each and a each slice and every and all, and like all these great features, but they're bleeding through. So if I wasn't checking the has-own property, I would see these things. And when you use jQuery, you might not see those things because jQuery says, I'm not going to touch the prototypes just because it could mess with people. So anyway, let's go back to where we were. Okay, this is a huge thing, and it might not get you right away, but scoping is different in JavaScript than it is in C#. C#, if I had an if statement with curly braces, between the curly braces, you would assume, well, you would be correct to assume in C# that any variables declared within that curly braces is scoped to those curly braces. There are exceptions if you do functional C#, but let's just say that's true. In JavaScript, that's not the case. JavaScript is a functional language, so scope is determined at the beginning of the function, at the end of the function. There could be 1,000 if statements and for loops inside the function. Any variables within even the nested ones will be accessible to the whole function. And so that could be very confusing if you have, especially if your functions get very large and you're not modularizing your code, you could run into some problems. So we're going to actually look at some of those problems. This is an exercise, and I'm showing you code in JavaScript, and then I'm going to interpret it and show you what the actual, when it runs, what the JavaScript language does to it. Like, it rips apart your language and shoves it in a very, there's some rules about it, but let's just talk about it. So here's some code you might write, which is, this is good that it's right before lunch, because you'll get hungry, because I have a lot of bacon examples. So we have an eat function, food, bacon, is hungry, is true, because I'm hungry. So if you are hungry, then let's wait 10 minutes, I don't know why. But you're waiting to eat, and then you chew. And so, yada, yada, yada. So the main point of this is you see that I have a main function, eat, and I have an if statement here. And then I'm declaring a variable, time to wait. And I'm doing it inside this if statement. Now, I might think as a C# person that it's going to stay here, that someone outside up here can't access it. But what the language really does is it, there's something called hoisting, and so it takes that declaration that used to be here, it used to be var time to wait, but when it actually runs the code, it hoists that declaration to the very top of the function. So it sticks it here instead, and it's always undefined. It hoists it to the very top and initializes it to undefined. It keeps the assignment same place that you intended, and in this case, it doesn't break the code. You know, hey, that's fine. You know, why should I change it? We could actually, I'm going to show some examples where, oops. Did I just lose all those? I think it's later. If you don't understand that, you could actually write code that's extremely confusing. So it's considered best practice. Kind of like, does anyone ever do VB6? Like, maybe I'm aging myself. Okay. Some people did. And what I was taught to do when I did VB6 is always declare your stuff at the very, dim your things at the top of the, you know, submodule. I don't remember what they're called. But then I went to C# and C, they're like, oh no, just declare it when you need it. You know, why waste memory? But really, since it is a functional language, it's considered best practice, just like in VB6. Don't compare the languages, but that's one similarity, to always declare them at the top. Oh, yeah, so this is where we get into. I'm going to skip this example because we kind of talked through it before, but as a side note, Carlos Ray Norris is Chuck Norris's real name. Okay. So here's an example that looks semi-harmless. But in some languages, it works. In some languages, it's an infinite loop. So you'll see, so it, like I mentioned, functions and variables in JavaScript are based on the function. Even in, it's a common case, and I have a for loop. I want to declare the integer or the I right in the for loop because that's really terse, and you know I don't want to have to declare it up there. Well, it turns out even those are hoisted in JavaScript as well. So essentially what this is doing, even though I have two vars, JavaScript says, oh, well, that's the same variable. I'm going to only hoist one of them up. And so the inner loop keeps resetting the outer loop, and this is kind of an infinite loop type of thing, which is not good. Now, it's kind of obvious when the code's really together, but imagine you're working with someone else who likes to write really long functions, and you can't see it on the screen. You're only looking at your code, and your buddy's code's down there, and he's redeclaring the same variable that you did, thinking it was unique, and really they're being shared, and it's a mess. So here's an example. Oh, stink. You can actually see it. But we'll go through it from top to bottom. So at the top, we're going to log out some variable. Now that's undefined. You're like, hey, that makes a lot of sense. I haven't defined that variable. And so like, sweet. So you're like, I'm going to declare that variable to 42 because that is the answer to everything, right? So that is considered a global variable. I know we did declare it, but if you're on the outermost scope and you declare a variable like that, it's attached to the window object, which is considered a global variable. So really anybody on your web page could call this at any time. And we'll talk about why that's good and bad later. So now we print out that variable, which we set to 42, and you're like, okay, it's 42. Things are making sense. Yeah. So later at the bottom of the page, I call do something. And then the first thing I do inside the function is log some variable. And it says it's undefined. I'm like, what? I just set it right here at the very bottom of the page. I call this this method. I didn't do anything else at the bottom of the page. All I did is call this function. It should be set to 42. Something must be wrong. And so you're like, well, I'm going to set it to something. So you set it to 1, and then you print it out, and it's 1. You're like, okay, things are making sense again. Yay. And then you're like, well, I'm going to print out the global sum variable just to make sure I did what I thought. And then you get 42, and you're like, what? 42? You're confused again. I just set it to 1. And then you're like thinking, ooh, I bet there's two variables here. And then you look down. I was hoping this would be off the screen. Sometimes it is based on my resolution. But some joker inside an if statement declared some variable, which happens to be the same name as the global one. But then it sees that as like, oh, that's a local variable to my function. So I'm going to hoist that up to the very tippy top of this function. So if we look over here, this is what it really did. Oh, now you can't see this statement. So here's the sum value. It took the var off. It kept the assignment, but it shoved the declaration to the very first thing after the function. So it set it to undefined. So now things make a lot more sense. That's why when I logged it out, it was undefined. And then that's when I set it. So like I said, it could get very confusing, hair-pulling, especially if your functions are really long. That's yet another good reason to make your functions very succinct. Know what you're doing. Okay, you think you might have mastered hoisting. Well, not only do variables hoist, but functions hoist. And there's a slightly different rule. So let's talk about that, because it's confusing as well. Okay, we're going to go to a top-down approach. We're going to assume we haven't done anything. We're not including any files. We're going to say, call a function. Say hello. So obviously, we haven't declared the function. There's nothing. It's just empty. You know, so you get an error that, hey, that's not defined. You can't call something that's undefined. So it would get inside the catch, you know, try catch thing. And then you call say goodbye. Now, if you look up here, we're not declaring anything up here. And then that works. You're like, what? Why would say hello work and say goodbye not? So that brings us into the difference between function expressions and function statements. There's multiple ways to assign functions in the language. One you might be more familiar with, possibly, I'm not sure, depending on how you learned, what resource you learned, is the function statement. You start with the word function, and then you give it a name and what to do. The other one is a function expression, and it looks very much similar to just setting a variable. Like, here's a variable, and then I set that equal to a function. So it's slightly different. But what the language does behind the scenes is for the ones that look like normal variables, like this one, it uses the same rules we just talked about. It keeps the assignment there, but it hoists the declaration, like, to the very top. But if it sees a function statement, it's like, oh, that's a special thing. What I'm going to do is convert that into a function expression and hoist both of them to the top. So that's why I was able to call say goodbye before I even declared it or even said anything about it. So if we were to look at what the language actually interprets it, is it maintains, it keeps the assignment of the function of say goodbye. I'm sorry. It hoisted say goodbye, the assignment and the declaration to the very top, because it was a function statement. But it kept the say hello where it was. So even though it on the previous slide say hello was above and say goodbye was below, it swapped them basically because one was an expression, one was a statement. Kind of confusing, but this is really good for beginners who don't know what they're doing, because they just define it anywhere they want and it's magically available to you, like yay. So that's kind of dangerous sometimes. But I still use them, and I'll show you when I use them. But usually, in most cases, I don't. I just do the var. Oh, stink. Sorry about that. I missed my place. Oh, I think I was close to it. So the best practice, which is similar to the best practice from the previous point, is to declare all your variables to the top of your function, because if you don't do it, JavaScript will for you. And it will be confusing because you're like, you might as well write code as if JavaScript interpreter is going to basically manipulate it, because that way it makes more sense to you how it's going to actually run. The next point is not understanding closures. This is a confusing topic, and I don't expect you to understand it. If you don't understand it, don't feel bad, because like I had to. You almost have to have learned. You almost have to write code that breaks, and then you're like, "Oh, this is why I need a closure to do it before it makes sense." And you might be smarter than me, and you're just like, "Oh, that makes total sense, Elijah. You're crazy." So let's look at an example of what the symptom of the problem that you need to solve with closures. So you don't have to know jQuery. I have a talk later about jQuery if you want to learn about it. But here's a for statement. We're just going looping 10 times, and we're going to create a list item. We're going to set its ID to whatever, you know, index it happens to be, 0, 1, 2, 3. We're going to give it text, so it'll say link 0, link 1, link 2, link 3. And then when they click on it, we want to actually print out, you've clicked 0, you've clicked 1, you've clicked 2, you've clicked 3. And we're appending the list items to the unordered list. So we should have an unordered list of list items. It seems harmless. And I have to refresh because JSFiddle sometimes is a little hokey in a presentation. Okay. So now we have link 0, 1, 2, 3. We're going to click on link 2. It says you've clicked 10. We're going to click on link 6. You've clicked 10. That looks like a bug to me. So this is so if you see this behavior where you're looping over something, and anytime you try to do a function or something, you're always getting the same value, and it tends to be the one that you did last, you probably need a closure. So what is a closure? So the Mozilla Developer Network, people who write Firefox and things like that, have a great resource to learn JavaScript. I would encourage you to look at that. But this is an example from their site. Their example is they have a make adder function, and it looks really weird because this function returns a function. You're like, okay, my mind just melted. But really what that does is it's kind of like a factory. You're like, I'm just going to make something new. So you're like, I'm going to make a new adder, and I want you to add things. I want the starting point of your adding to start at 5. And this one says, I want you to make an adding machine, and it starts at 10. And so now we have an adding machine that if we add anything to it, it will take that and add 5. And here's an add 10 machine, and all it knows how to do is take a number and add it to 10. But the reason it knows how to do that is because we primed it. We passed in a number here, so this would have been 5. And then we say, okay, well, the real function that you want to run when someone calls add 5 is this one, function y, pass in something new, like a 2. And then I want you to remember what you passed when I created you. So 5 will be enclosed in that function. It's like a memory capsule that to be used for later. And so inside this make adder, it just remembers 5 to all of its heart. It's enclosed around that 5. It loves that 5. And then so when you call 2, it will remember, hey, that was 5. I'm going to add 2 to it, and that will be 7. Same thing with 10. Okay. Hopefully I did some justice to that. I don't know. But anyway, the way to solve this problem is to add a closure. So it remembers the index that you wanted to print out and not the last one. So the code looks kind of funky. So whereas before, I just had function console. Now I have a function that returns a function, which is what the make adder looked like. And so, but what we're doing down here is, here is the adder function. And then we say, we want to actually call that immediately with the index. And so I, which is, let's assume it's a 5. 5 gets passed in here as index. And index is console. So at this point, whatever I was passed in is enclosed in this inner function. And it will always remember that. Now, the syntax looks funny. There's another way to do it, is to actually to pull that code out in its own function. It's the same thing. I have a function that returns a function. But it looks a little cleaner when I actually wire it up. So when I say click, I just say click event handler, passing I. So it's the same idea. And both of those work correctly. Actually, so link 2 prints out 2, link 5 prints out 5. So if you don't understand that, that's fine. Just if you can remember anything, is just, well, obviously you can't remember something, but just remember the side effect when you might need a closure. If you see the same behavior over and over again, and that's not what you intended, then maybe you need a closure, and maybe you could study it more at that time. This is the last point, but there's a lot to it because it's a pretty important point. I mentioned before, if you just declare something out of the blue, that's not in a function, that's just kind of out there. It gets added to the global scope. So off window, you got access it off window. That's a bad thing. Not only you don't want just your code to be floating around, there's a chance of naming conflicts. If you're including libraries, just, you know, hey, I want 20 jQuery plugins because they're awesome. Well, they might be mucking with the Windows namespace, and you could have conflicts and et cetera. But you're like, you might say, well, I have pretty much control over what I'm doing. I don't have to worry about this concern. Actually, you do have to worry about it, because if you use Chrome or Firefox and you like add-ons or extensions to the browser, which I have like a billion, each of those plugins or extensions actually is running in your tab on your browser. Like if you hit open up your web dev tools, you'll see when you click scripts, you'll see like, where do all these scripts come from? Well, like half of them are from extensions that you've installed on your browser. And they're running alongside of your code. And so they could conceivably not know what they're doing and be clashing with your variables if you have them in the global namespace, like off the window. So you want to try to make as few things as possible so you're not colliding. So this is this is a global variable. It's just out there. It's not inside a function or anything. You want to keep those to a minimum. And it's also, if you don't declare a variable at all, even if it's nested inside of a function, it's like, oh, you've never declared that. I bet you want that accessible everywhere. So it will, if you don't put a var, it will put it, make it global for you. So don't do that. That's really bad because you probably didn't intend to do that. So the one way you'll see people, oh yeah, so when we call a function, it does the same thing. It's globally accessible everywhere, which for beginners, hey, that's cool, I guess. So you'll see some clever people in libraries like, oh, I'm going to prepend something unique to every function name, like my project underscore and then function name. And so every function has this crazy unique identifier because they want to namespace their stuff so it doesn't conflict with other code. And that's a very hacky way to do that. You'll see a lot of old examples that talk about that, mainly because we learned better ways to do that. Yeah, so all these things above are accessible off the window because they're all global, and that's not good. So how do we alleviate that? I'm going to show four different techniques. They have pros and cons. The easiest one is an object literal. We've already kind of seen this from the person that I created, like first couple slides where I had the first name, last name, and say hello. That was an object literal. So it's just newing up an object and giving it keys and values. So the values could be strings, numbers, functions. But the cool thing about that is now that's all enclosed in an object of Skillet. So I could call Skillet, but Skillet's the only thing on the window that's global. Ingredient and fry are not global. They're actually inside of that object. So, hey, I've cleaned up the namespace already. Yay. So if I want to call it, I just Skillet ingredient or Skillet fry, and they work as normal. And because JavaScript's very dynamic in nature, you could actually add new properties after the fact. So even though I only initially put an ingredient and fry on it, well, I'd say, well, I want Skillet to have a quantity of 12. And you could print that out, and that works fine. You could add new methods after the fact. I want a toString, so I'll just define it. So you're just augmenting what you've already defined. And if you can't do anything at all, do that because it protects the global namespace. It protects your code against plugins that come in your browser and from other libraries. So that's a good thing. A good thing and a bad thing is everything's public. You might not want everything public. You might want some things that are private that only the things within your function could access and not just some random person. So that's a con. And also the con is the syntax looks, if you notice, it looks a little different than it used to. It has a colon and has commas. You know, it just doesn't feel as nice as like an equals and a, you know, semicolon. And if you're not used to that syntax, it looks like JSON. And it's a similar language as JSON, but technically it's different. But if you are familiar with JSON anyway, you're like, oh, it looks fine. So the next technique is using something called a self-executing anonymous function. That's a mouthful, but let me show you. That's awful. So normally this is, can you see that? Let me zoom in. So this is a function statement, as we talked about. Wouldn't it be cool if we could have a function, declare it, and have it run immediately? So you're like, well, wouldn't it be cool if, if I could do that, maybe I could do this, because it doesn't need a name, and what if I just called it immediately? Would that work? That's essentially what we want to do. We want to, because we want anything, because we know anything in here has it a special scope, because we know functions keep their scope. So our intent is to create just our scope wrapper to make sure everything's contained. But unfortunately, you can't do this. The parser in JavaScript doesn't like this. But it turns out if you just put some character here, it doesn't matter what it is. It could be, well, it doesn't matter what, but it could be a couple things. But a typical approach is you just wrap that whole function in braces and then call it. And that works. So this is called a self-executing anonymous function. It's self-executing because it's calling itself. It's anonymous because there's no name, and it's a function. So there's other names for it, immediately invoked function expression. And anyway, but essentially that's the concept I'm trying to. So we're going to use that concept. We're going to have a function with no name, call itself. And inside of it, we're going to put all the code that we had before. This is like a one-time only use. We'll see later how we get reuse it, but so because there's no name, so we can't call it again because we don't know what to call. You know, there's nothing to reference. And so it basically sets an ingredient in a fry, and internally inside of this we say fry. So all this does is fry once, and it can never fry again. It's like the one-time fryer because there's no way to get it. If I try to say window ingredient, it's not accessible. There's no way to. It's just, anyway, so you might need that. The benefit is it's all private. I cannot get to anything ever again. you might want that. If you have a function that runs only once and you never want anyone else to call again, that might be a good way to do it. The pro is also it looks normal. You have equals and semicolons. You don't have all the colons and commas. But it's slightly more complicated. It's a con, you know, you get this weird syntax of it calling itself, and you kind of get used to that. But I used to, the next thing is, and I've kind of gone on this progression as well. Like I used to use object literals to begin with, and then I didn't really go to the all private because that seemed kind of silly. But then I went to this one. It's called the revealing module pattern. I used this for a long time. It's really good. You could have private properties, public properties, private methods, public methods. It's kind of more what you're maybe used to in a C# development. So we're going to use that same technique again of we're going to have a function with no name, and at the bottom we're going to call it immediately, just like we did before. But now we're going to store it. We're going to save it off. So now we can actually do something with it. Because before we didn't save it off. It just like it was in the abyss. So what we're going to do now is the very first thing we're going to do is we're going to declare something called pub. Now, the word public is reserved, even though the language doesn't use it, so I couldn't use the word public because obviously it's reserved. So pub is supposed to mean anything that's public I want to add to this. So I'm going to make a new object that's pub. Anything that's not, anything I don't add to pub is private. So this variable, amount of grease, that's really good. One cup of grease. Yum. So that's private. Nothing could access it except things inside here. Now, I want ingredient to be public, so I'll add that. I'll do pub.ingredient. I'm attaching the ingredient to the things that are public. Now, bacon strips. I want fry to be public, so I say pub.fry. I want also a private method. So I essentially don't add it to pub. I just put it out there. And you see here I'm using the function statement. So sometimes I'll use those in here because I don't care, really. It's only going to hoist to the top of this function, and that's fine. But the last thing I do is return public things. So essentially that what's going to do is when I return the execution of this anonymous function to the skillet will now have access to whatever I had attached to pub. And I can't do pub dot amount of grease because I didn't attach it to pub. So we could here's some code just to prove that. I can't get ingredient. Yeah, because that was off pub. I can call fry. With this technique, I could still add to the skillet because JavaScript's dynamic in nature. But the dynamic things I add to it still can't access the private. Parts that I said were private. But anything after the fact can be public. And actually, in this technique, there's no way to, after the fact, add private things. The last thing I'm going to talk about can do pretty much everything in the world. Not really, but... So there's a lot of pros for this one. The code looks a little bit more normal. at the top with the equals. Once you get used to the function expression anonymous thing, it's not too bad. But the one con is there's no way to add private things later. Like, once you define it once, I want to go and add something private later. And so the last point, I'm just going to show how to do this. This is the most complicated, but it's building off all the points that we talked about. Now, you'll see this technique used in libraries that have a lot of modules, like jQuery doesn't do this, but just think of a library that has a lot of things that are kind of unique, but they all kind of work off each other. I can't think of a good example offhand, but we'll show how this could work together. So we have this anonymous function that's called immediately, but now we have some parameters up here, whereas before we weren't really passing anything in. So now we're passing in skillet, a dollar sign, and undefined. You're like, well, that's kind of funky. What are you doing here? So at the bottom, whereas we're always just open paren, close paren, we're now passing in two things. We're passing in the skillet, which is essentially our namespace, and we're passing in jQuery. Now, the reason we pass in jQuery is because there's other libraries that like the dollar sign as well. You might like the dollar sign, but you should be responsible and protect yourself somehow against other libraries. Because, you know, depending on the order that they're included on your page, they could conflict. And so essentially I'm passing the full name jQuery here, but at the top I'm the argument is, or the parameter is dollar sign. So I'm safely able to use the dollar sign in this function because it's really jQuery because I passed it in. Now, the other one looked a little funky. And the first time I saw this, I'm like, what in the world is that doing? So we'll take a second to talk about this. Now, this includes, like, the first three points maybe I made. One is setting default values. So what this will do the very first time is we'll look at window.skillet. So now we know anything off Windows global. So we're like, okay, is there a global skillet anywhere? If that's falsy, meaning it's null or undefined or zero or not a number, yada, yada. It's like, oh, no one's declared it yet, so I'm going to default it to a new object. So this is using the object literal notation to create a new object. And it will save that back to the window skillet. So we're kind of priming the pump. The very first time, we're like, okay, it's not there. We're going to make it. We're going to pass it in, and we're going to build up our module. The next, let's say there's another script file. You've already defined a really cool feature. Now you want another cool feature. You're going to use the same technique again to add new code. So now when it does this check, is there a window.skillet? It goes, oh, yes, there is. I had just created one for a previous feature. So it will just use that and save it back to itself. And so and then it passes that in, and we add functionality. So it's a way to build up a really complex library in multiple files. And using the same namespace without cluttering the global namespace. So we're almost to the point where everything inside of this is the same techniques we've done before. The only thing that I haven't talked about is, well, I'm only passing in two things at the bottom. Why is there a third parameter undefined? This is for multiple reasons. One reason is, although public is a reserved word, and that's why I couldn't use it. Undefined, unfortunately, is not a reserved word in ECMAScript 4. I mean, 3. And so some joker could take undefined and set it to true, and it would hose all your code that tests against undefined. So kind of a little side effect of functions, if you don't pass in something, like if I have three parameters at the top, and I only pass in two, it will always set whatever you didn't fill in as undefined. And so I'm enforcing that undefined is always really the value undefined. It's kind of a weird way to do it. But you're protecting yourself from either other code or other people on your team from accidentally changing what the meaning of undefined is, because that is one of our falsy values, of our six falsy values. And if we screw up what our falsy values is, it screws up everything else we've talked about. So it's just a clever way to do that. It also can help with minification. If you use that a lot, it could help minify that a little more. The rest of the code is the same concepts. We're just adding to the skillet. Anything we want public, we're adding to the namespace. Anything we want private, we just don't. But the cool thing about this is if we do the same technique again, then we could add more public things and more private things, and we could do it again and add more public and private, and we could keep building up this really complex library with the ability to still have public and private things. Now, when you add to it later, its public things can't access private things that were that were in another script, and there's protection there, but it really has the most bang for the buck. Like, you're protecting yourself from other libraries, like prototype dojo YUI with the dollar sign, your public, private, all this good stuff. It looks normal. And so the best practice is to limit the number of global variables that you have. And using these techniques, even if it's the object literal that we showed at the beginning, the easiest one, that still helps you in the long run. Because you might think, well, what's the likelihood of my code breaking with a plugin? Well, there's a website that I used to use a lot. It's like JS Fiddle, the one I'm embedding everywhere. It's called JS Ben. I still sometimes go back and forth between them. Remy Sharp, he's a jQuery developer. He's on the core team. He wrote it. It's really awesome. And one day, I was like, it's broken. So I chatted with him. Like, hey, did you know that JS Ben's broke? And he tested it. And he's like, well, not for me. And he had me kind of debugging through the web console. And it turns out that one of my plugins was redefining something that he had defined. But he still had a very few number of things in the global namespace, but someone else had a billion things, and it was just clashing with one of them. It was breaking the website. And so anyway, I set a bug request or an issue on the GitHub of the plugin, and they eventually fixed it. But that could happen to you. So. Now you might be thinking, well, how am I going to remember all this stuff that you just talked about? That's a lot of stuff. Isn't there a tool to help me? I'm like, yes, there is. JS Lint will help you. Let me see if I could open it real quick. I should have. Oh, stink. I hope I still have it. I have a compilation of all the bad code I wrote in this presentation. Like when I said, here's one way and here's probably a better way to do it. Let me see if I can find that real quick so we can copy and paste that into the tool. And great. I'm getting all these. So I'm going to paste in pretty much all the code that was from the presentation. Oh, I have it on extremely strict. There's a lot of options you can turn on. Like some of it's like your white space. Like he complains about that. But if you look here, it says I expected a not double equals, and I saw a not equals. It's like here, and so it's like saying you might not want to do that. And then. Here is expecting a triple equals and not a double equals. I should have turned up that feature. There's too many. Ah, here you go. Now, this is a kind of obscure one, but maybe you recognize it now that we talked about it. The body of a for n should be wrapped in an if statement to filter out our unwanted properties from the prototype. Now, that's essentially what we talked about. Like, your base class, if you have a for in which goes over the keys of an object, you have to test, like, do I own that? And so this tool tested that it saw I had a for in and I didn't have that check. And it's like, hey, you might want to do that. So so that's kind of cool. Here's one that was actually clever. The first technique I showed protecting against the closure, I had, when I set the clicked function, I was creating a new function there every time, and it looked a little odd, and then I revised it and said, here's how you could pull out the function and just set it. This is actually saying, well, don't make functions inside of for loop. So it's actually is encouraging me to split that out. So that's kind of nice. And then, anyway, it has lots of stuff. We could, at the very bottom, there's all these checkboxes. And you can actually integrate this in with your build tools, or there's a plugin for Visual Studio, for Vim, for, you know, TextMate, and like all these things that you, whatever you want. So as for some resources, I think we're done. But JavaScript, the good parts, but Douglas Crockford is really good. Most of these points kind of came from there, because I was reading it at the time when I was doing that front-end architecture review. There's another book called JavaScript Patterns, which is really good. Script Junkies has a lot of nice web articles.